So record. Is that okay with people?
Sounds all right. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Recording.
Two-point agenda. One is the presentation on Trotsky's The Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 5, Part 1. And the other is anything else, really, at the end. Yeah. Okay. So I will start talking about Chapter 5 of The Revolution Betrayed, which is the title of the chapter is The Soviet Thermidor. We're going to split it into several, into three parts because the chapter is in three parts, and I think they are slightly complementary subject matter, which probably could be dealt with separately. It would be a good idea to have that level of in-depth discussion of it because it's complex stuff, or at least some of it is, you know. So, I mean, just starting on, I mean, the first part is titled "Why Stalin Triumphed." And it goes, you know, it goes through a lot of interesting material, but I'll just preface it by saying that regarding the left opposition and its record, it's quite clear that the left opposition was able to exercise foresight in the various conflicts and contentious issues that took place in the USSR after the death of Lenin just over 100 years ago. And the classic example is over the question of collectivization and the Kulak. But there are several others. But let's recap on the question of collectivization first, because the left opposition, as early ni as 1923, pointed to the so-called scissors crisis, the diversion of prices of industrial and agricultural goods, as threatening to break the class alliance between the workers and peasants. That was the foundation stone of the revolution. And of course, this was symbolized by the hammer and sickle, of course, you know. So the high prices of industrial goods were themselves a symbol of low productivity, but they diverged from the much lower price of agricultural goods, which was also a symbol of underdevelopment of agriculture and low productivity by a huge and impoverished peasantry. And to remedy this situation, the left opposition proposed a measured program of collectivization of agriculture in the countryside through material and moral incentives and planned industrial development in the cities. And the aim of this was to establish an equilibrium between the two components of the economy and develop a harmonious economic growth benefiting both. For this position, they were denounced as super industrializers by their opponents in the party, the Troika and the Bukharin right wing. The Troika being Stalin, Zinoviev, and Kamenev. These forces preferred to extend NEP beyond its original purpose and achieve economic growth through giving great latitude to the wealthier layers of the peasantry to enrich themselves. And that led to the growth of the Kulak class. Unease at this developing threat actually split the Troika in 1926, and Zinoviev and Kamenev broke with Stalin over this and joined with the Trotskyists in the joint opposition, sometimes known as the United Opposition. And though they proved weak and soon capitulated, this was an important demonstration of the correctness of the left opposition. And later, Stalin was forced to break with Bukharin when the indulgence of the Kulaks. For instance, Bukharin was known to have sort of called on the peasants to enrich the kulaks effectively to enrich themselves. When the indulgence of the kulaks led to the kulaks attempting by grain strikes to overthrow the Soviet regime and gain complete economic freedom, that is capitalist freedom, to exploit the poor peasantry and the working class through high prices backed with the threat of starvation. So Stalin actually broke with Bukharin and was forced to collectivize agriculture by methods of civil war and to institute economic planning. So you saw the advent of 5-year plans, which really began in 1928. But this led to attempts to jump over material reality and use administrative measures to industrialize the country without a stable currency, with ruinous effects of inflation on the workers and a major famine in the countryside that caused millions of deaths on an all-union basis, not just in Ukraine, as some people would like you to believe. So, subsequent to that, the Stalin regime was forced to retreat and stabilize the currency and thereby stabilize the economy, I suppose. And yet it persisted in voluntary efforts to jump over material reality with such things as shock brigades, which were related to Stakhanovism, which used the most brutal form of capitalist remuneration, i.e. piecework, which damages the workers' labour power itself. And the Stalin regime tried to dress this up as being some way socialist, when it was actually nothing of the sort. So, it's quite clear from this record that the left opposition exercised forceps every step of the way. This is confining matters to domestic economic policy, of course. It's still lost. It was subjected to ferocious persecution in the USSR, and in the course of the 1930s, it was essentially wiped out in the USSR. The first section of chapter 5 deals with why this happened. And it points out that it's not enough to be right in many circumstances. Trotsky addressed this question of the superior political opposition, he said that this is, quote, contradicted at first glance by the simple fact that the faction that could not see ahead was steadily victorious, while the more penetrating group suffered defeat after defeat. And he explained why. It's a little bit of a complex explanation, but it's comprehensible. He said that kind of objection, which comes automatically to mind, is convincing, however, only for those who think rationalistically and see in politics as a logical argument or a chess match. The political struggle is in its essence a struggle of interests and forces, not of arguments. The quality of the leadership is, of course, far from a matter of indifference to the outcome of the conflict. But it's not the only factor, and in the last analysis is not decisive. Each of the struggling camps, moreover, demands leaders in its own image. And he goes on, he gives many examples, not just from the history of the USSR, the then recent history of the USSR, but from other periods and situations. So he writes about the period after the February Revolution. He writes that, that's in 1917, he writes that, quote, the February Revolution raised Kerensky and Tsereteli to power, not because they were cleverer or more astute than the ruling Tsarist clique, but because they represented, at least temporarily, the revolutionary masses of the people in their revolt against the old regime. Kerensky was able to drive Lenin underground and imprison other Bolshevik leaders, not because he excelled them in personal qualifications, but because the majority of workers and soldiers in those days were still following the patriotic petty bourgeoisie. The personal superiority of Kerensky, in quotes, if it's suitable to employ such a word in this connection, consisted in the fact that he did not see further than the overwhelming majority. The Bolsheviks, in their turn, conquered the petty bourgeois democrats, not through the personal superiority of their leaders, but through a new correlation of social forces. The proletariat had succeeded at last in leading the discontented present peasantry against the bourgeoisie. Can everybody hear me, by the way? I see Emma has arrived. Can you hear me? Just checking. Can you let me know if you can't? But that way. I'll carry on anyway. I must carry on. Likewise, from the history of the French Revolution, Trotsky talks about similar things. He wrote that the consecutive stages of the Great French Revolution, during its rise and fall alike, demonstrate no less convincingly that the strength of the leaders and heroes, in quotes, that replaced each other consisted primarily in their correspondence to the character of the class of those classes and strata which supported them. Only this correspondence, and not in any irrelevant superiorities whatsoever, permitted each of them to place the impress of his personality upon a certain historic period. In the successive supremacy of Mirano, Brissot, Robespierre, Barras, and Bonaparte, there's an obedience to objective law incomparably more effective than the special traits of the historic protagonists themselves. And that touches on the question of similar phenomena related to the worker state after the revolution, with relevance of the subject matter of this whole chapter, which we'll look relevance to the subject matter of this whole chapter, which we'll look at it in more detail a bit later on. So Trotsky writes again. He writes that he writes, "It's sufficiently well known that every revolution up to this time has been followed by a reaction, or even a counter-revolution. This, to be sure, has never thrown the nation all the way back to its starting point, but it always takes from the people the lion's share of their conquests. The victims of the first revolutionary wave have been, as a general rule, those pioneers, initiators, and instigators who stood at the head of the masses in the period of revolutionary offensive. In their stead, people of the second line, in league with the former enemies of the revolution, have been advanced to the front. Beneath this dramatic duel of what he calls coryphees on the open political scene, and what coryphees are, it's a metaphor actually about the interaction of ballet dancers. It's a very Russian thing. He talks about the dramatic duel of coryphees on the open political scene. Shifts have taken place in the relations between classes, and no less important, profound changes in the psychology of the recently revolutionary masses." So, this is really connected with the paradox of the permanent revolution process that commenced when the working class of the Russian Empire, the most backward of the imperialist powers in the European War, took power in October 1917. So Trotsky writes about this again. He writes that the axiomatic assertions of the Soviet literature to the effect that the laws of bourgeois revolutions are inapplicable to a proletarian revolution have no scientific content whatsoever. The proletarian character of the October Revolution was determined by the world situation and by a special correlation of internal forces. But the classes themselves were formed in the barbarous circumstances of Tsarism and backward capitalism, and were anything but made to order for the demands of a socialist revolution. The exact opposite is true. That's what he wrote about that. But and that produced a huge contradiction in material reality itself, which he goes on to explain. He says, "It is for this very reason that a proletariat, still backward in many respects, achieved in the space of a few months the unprecedented leap from a semi-feudal monarchy to a socialist dictatorship, that the reaction in its ranks was inevitable. This reaction has developed in a series of consecutive waves. External conditions of events have vied with each other in nourishing it. Intervention followed intervention. The revolution got no direct help from the West. Instead of the expected prosperity of the country, an ominous destitution reigned for long. Moreover, the outstanding representatives of the working class either died in the Civil War or rose a few steps higher and broke away from the masses. And thus, after an unexampled tension of forces, hopes, and delusions, there came a long period of weariness, decline, and sheer disappointment in the results of the revolution. The ebb of the plebeian pride made room for a flood of pusillanimity and careerism. The new commanding caste rose to its place upon this wave." And this had bearing on the conflict in the countryside, which culminated in the Kulak revolt at the end of the 1920s. And it's Trotsky again. He says that the reaction within the proletariat caused an extraordinary flush of hope and confidence in the petty bourgeois strata of town and country, aroused as they were to new life by the NEP and growing bolder and bolder. The young bureaucracy, which had arisen at first as an agent of the proletariat, began to feel itself a court of arbitration between classes. Its independence increased from month to month. And of course, this is not solely a or even primarily a matter of purely domestic politics. The entire context of all these struggles was the situation on a much broader international level that Trotsky spelled out thus. He said, the international situation was pushing with mighty forces in the same direction. The Soviet bureaucracy became more self-confident, the heavier blows dealt to the working class. Between these two facts, there was not only a chronological, but a causal connection, and one which worked in two directions. The leaders of the bureaucracy promoted the proletarian defeats. The defeats promoted the rise of the bureaucracy. The crushing of the Bulgarian insurrection in 1924, the treacherous liquidation of the general strike in England, and the unworthy conduct of the Polish Workers' Party at the installation of Pilsudski in 1926, the terrible massacre of the Chinese Revolution in 1927, and finally, the still more ominous recent defeats in Germany and Austria, he's speaking in 1936, of course. These are the historic catastrophes which killed the faith of the Soviet masses in world revolution and permitted the bureaucracy to rise higher and higher as the sole light of salvation. And that's the point. The left opposition were able to foresee the practical problems of the USSR's internal economic policy because their perspective was one of preparing for and fighting for the international revolution as the only ultimate salvation of the Soviet state. Whereas the developing bureaucracy, on the other hand, was forced to zigzag from one flawed policy to the opposite, repeatedly, because it rejected the primacy of the world revolution as the objective of the Soviet state and sought to solve their problems on a purely national basis, as basically expressed in the theory of socialism in one country. But the problem with that is that the objective interest of the USSR could only be successfully developed, so defended in the long term by means of the world revolution. And yet the bureaucracy grew stronger because of the defeats it had itself brought about. Trotsky comments about this and he writes about the defeat in Germany, strengthening the bureaucracy. He writes, the irrefutable and instructive fact that the continual defeats of the revolution in Europe and Asia, while weakening the international position of the Soviet Union, have vastly strengthened the Soviet bureaucracy. Two dates are especially significant in this historic series. In the second half of 1923, the attention of the Soviet workers was passionately fixed upon Germany, where the proletariat, it seemed, had stretched out its hand to power. But the panicky retreat of the German Communist Party was the heaviest possible disappointment to the working masses of the Soviet Union. The Soviet bureaucracy straight away opened a campaign against the theory of permanent revolution and dealt the left opposition its first cruel blow. And something similar happened over China. Trotsky comments again over slightly later events in China. He wrote that during the years 1926 and 1927, the population of the Soviet Union experienced a new tide of hope. All eyes were now directed to the east, where the drama of the Chinese Revolution was unfolding. The left opposition had recovered from the previous blows and was recruiting a phalanx of new adherents. At the end of 1927, the Chinese Revolution was massacred by the hangman, Chiang Kai-shek, into whose hands the Communist International had literally betrayed the Chinese workers and peasants. A cold wave of disappointment swept over the masses of the Soviet Union. After an unbridled baiting in the press and at meetings, the bureaucracy finally, in 1928, ventured upon mass arrests among the left opposition. And the contradiction of the contradiction in the consciousness of the masses gave rise to this, as Trotsky says. He says, the gospel of repose firmly consolidated the apparatchiki and the military and state officials, and indubitably found an echo among the weary workers, and still more the peasant masses. Can it be, they ask themselves, that the opposition is actually ready to sacrifice the interests of the Soviet Union for the idea of permanent revolution? In reality, the struggle had been about the life interests of the Soviet state. The false policy of the International in Germany resulted 10 years later in the victory of Hitler, that is, in a threatening war danger from the West. And the no less false policy in China reinforced Japanese imperialism and brought very much nearer the danger in the East. But periods of reaction are characterized above all by a lack of courageous thinking. And Trotsky drew the conclusion of this analysis. He says, the opposition was isolated. The bureaucracy struck while the iron was hot, exploiting the bewilderment and passivity of the workers, setting their more backward strata against the advanced, and relying more and more boldly upon the kulak and the petty bourgeois ally in general. In the course of a few years, the bureaucracy shattered the revolutionary vanguard of the proletariat. Okay, so that sets the scene for the next two parts of the chapter, on the degeneration of the party and on Thermidor itself. I'll leave it here for now and go further into the programmatic implications of all this and due course. But the sentence above that Trotsky sort of paraphrases, can it be, they ask themselves, that the opposition is actually ready to sacrifice the interests of the Soviet Union for the idea of permanent revolution? That idea really does encapsulate the illusion in the mind of the masses that fed the growth of the bureaucracy. Because the entire concept is a contradiction in terms. It was and can only be the product of exhaustion. Because the only way the new forms of property created by the revolution, precisely because of their character of being more advanced in historical terms than the most advanced capitalism, the only way they could thrive is on an international scale. Because that's one of the key elements of the obsolescence of capitalism. The soil of capitalism is the national state, but the productive forces it created, already by 1914, have overgrown the same national state. The imperialist war itself, which tore apart the world as the various imperialists fought each other to transcend their national boundaries, was proof of that. Now, socialism transcends the national state. Marx and Engels actually pointed out this logic as early as 1847 in the Communist Manifesto. The attempt to confine the socialist revolution within national borders could only be a means of stifling it and extending the life of capitalism. So this is not some sort of liberal abstract idealism, but fundamentally a product of the deep-rooted inner needs of the productive forces themselves. I'll conclude there, and we'll go to discussion, but I think that really sums up the thesis of the first part of this chapter of Trotsky's work anyway. And we can go on and discuss the rest in other... I'll touch on the material now, but we can discuss it in more depth, the rest of the chapter, in a couple of week's time or whatever. I'll leave it there. Thank you, comrades, and open it up to discussion. Cheers. Anybody want to speak? Marie? Anybody else?
Yeah, I will speak if nobody else wants to come first. Okay.
Right.
Thank you, Ian. This is superbly presented, and also it is a very fundamental document. I see the need of it on many levels. One, to understand why the revolution retreated, why there was a Thermidor. The importance, it seems to me, is that we must not have developed the idea that we will have a Thermidor every time that there is a revolution. But nevertheless, one can foresee that in the antagonism of classes, once power has been taken, it's not enough, then power has to be kept. And that is because the class that has just been superseded just doesn't go away. And in our case here, it's private property in the end, which is being overcome. This is 1917 marks the time when private property for the first time is challenged and replaced with collective and planned property. And this was a leap in humanity, which marks, it makes a mark on all historic periods. And so no wonder that in a country which had been several times devastated and which had lost its best communists in the Civil War and then in the running of the economy, no wonder that it was such a fantastically difficult task with tremendous reverses. I think another level of the document is in the method, the way of thinking. So one can actually tackle a historic period from the point of view of knowing a lot about it. The other aspect is to see why things developed as they did. And I particularly remarked the beginning of the document where Trotsky says, how come that the left opposition was more correct, it was more penetrating, and it had foreseen and actually developed programs to respond to the difficulties before they were actually completed. And yet, Trotsky got thrown out, and all his comrades one thing which is not said very often, because Trotsky doesn't like to say so, but how much they were persecuted, and people were put in jail for having said something that the bureaucracy would adopt the next day, which the crassness and the incompetence of the bureaucracy, and yet it came to the fore and acquired even more power. And so, I think in the way of method, when we look at events around ourselves, the point is not to point to this leader and that other leader and to name a process through the leader, but to see that the people who come forward in a process, like, for example, the French one, and then there was this series of people that you mentioned, Ian, Mirabeau, Brissot, Robespierre, Barras, and Bonaparte. They form part of the revolution that grows and the revolution that declines. So it was not that these people had guided history through this curve. It is that the class and the mass process underneath was throwing up these people each time, throwing the people who were corresponding to the interest of a strata which was coming forward. And it's important this because then that allows to understand in a material way, not in an idealized way through individuals. It's not individuals who are running history. It is a multitude and it is the classes. And behind that is a development of the productive forces. I think what pushed the Soviet Union, made it come about, was a development of the productive forces, which capitalism was incapable of harnessing. So then there was only one way by which a revolutionary process could accomplish itself. It was through the unification of the workers and the peasants. As said in introduction, it is very important, this, because as soon as the revolution retreats, the gulf, the chasm between the two reopens. And it reopens not because Stalin came along with a gun. It reopens because of if the policy of the leaders is you go and enrich yourself, like Bukharin had said to the kulaks, get rich. This was the equivalent of a gun, and of a much more powerful than a gun, because that was an encouragement to a few people to go and retake the ownership of or forms of ownership of the land in order to exploit again the workers and the poor peasants and the agricultural workers. And so that gulf reopens through policies, not through the violence of the method, even though that also existed here. And so the reason why I wanted to say that is because I see all around me the analysis that we make very often are idealists, whereas this document shows the materialist interpretation to be made of the process. And so just to finish, I will talk again later on, all the reasons for the Thermidor, which were that had Lenin survived, Krupskaya said that he would have ended up in jail. And in my opinion, I'm not sure about that, but he was probably bumped off. He was forced out the way he was attacked. Somebody tried to kill him, and that was already part of the process of the beginning of ambitions of counter-revolution. And then he declined, and in his decline, he could not stop the process, but he had foreseen much of it, and that allowed that his death in particular allowed the second line of those who had been on the wrong side of the barricades during the revolution. There you find them in all the places in the government. I mean, these are things to note, these are things to remember. And then the psychological change in people, those who made the revolution and those who loved it and those who became disappointed, all these people, people are not made of plastic. And even in the revolution, one can lose confidence when the spirit, the character can collapse. And all this happened in the wake of all the reverses that Ian showed with the defeat of the German Revolution, and then the defeat of don't forget the general strike in 26, where Stalin intervened in 1926 to help defeat the general strike in Britain. And then the other thing, it was China, which would have changed the face of the earth had there not been the policy of the Second International to actually fail that revolution. So just in conclusion, it comes to my mind that the perspective of the world revolution, which was that of the Bolsheviks, Stalin did not just bury it, but he actively used the international to actually make sure that it would fail. He was a great organizer of defeats, and from those defeats came more retreats internally, more disappointment, and then the bureaucracy became stronger. The interesting thing I would like to say in conclusion, the interesting thing is that it never went back. It did not go back to square one. Much of the gains won by the masses were retaken, and yet this revolution did not go back. And I think there is here two things later on, I would like to return on here. Thank you.
Okay, that's really good. Anybody else want to speak?
Could Marie expand on what she said about the Chinese Revolution being
Been defeated, yeah.
yeah,
Defeated.
the second international on the Chinese Revolution.
Yeah, so there was a Communist Party. All these Communist Parties after 1920, after 1917, we must be fair to them. They were all new parties. They had been in existence only a few years when they were confronted with major decisions, and few were in China, there was a lot of Trotskyists. But they were all absolutely in 1927, 28, 29, they were all assassinated, pursued, and Stalin did help that. So in answer to you, Emma, I'm trying to not to be too long because I would like other comrades to speak. The Second International had a section in China, and the Communist Party there took, under the leadership of Stalin, took the line that the communists should make a united front with the nationalists, the bourgeois nationalists. This bloc was called Kai-shek, the very one who took refuge in Taiwan, which now world capitalism says, oh ho, Taiwan doesn't belong to China. I hope we come back on this scandal. And does that answer you, Emma, or is there some? And
Thank
then
you.
the nationalists assassinated all the communists.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Did you mean the Second International or the Third International when you were talking
Sorry,
about?
I meant the third. Yeah, the
Yeah,
third.
I thought so. Yes, yeah.
Yes,
I'm not
okay.
aware that the Second International had anything of any significance in China. The Kuomintang played a similar role in some ways, but it wasn't really. In fact, the Kuomintang actually affiliated to the Third International at one point, but that was pure camouflage, and Stalin allowed that to be done, you know, because of his opportunism. There's the old joke about about when the bourgeoisie is under threat. If it's under sufficient threat, you might see and it actually did happen that the bourgeoisie will march to Moscow singing the Internationale to camouflage itself. And actually, the Chinese, the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce did something very similar because it passed the resolution. The Shanghai Chamber of Commerce in 1926, I think it was, passed the revolution calling for the establishment of the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry, or something like that. It was just pure camouflage. And they were hiding in this ambiguity about what was democratic and what was socialist, you know. So they're trying to make sure that whatever was established didn't actually abolish capitalism. Although it's the way the bourgeoisie can try to camouflage itself in a in a developing country, in an oppressed country, in conditions of revolution. It's quite remarkable, actually.
Yeah, perfidious. One cannot expect anything but perfidiousness from them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Otherwise, people say, oh, perhaps we can convince them they will become peaceful, we can have coexistence. All that was shit. It was shit, the coexistence.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it is murderous.
Anybody?
Emma, you could.
Yeah, sorry. Anybody else want to speak? Sorry. Oh, yeah.
And perhaps Emma wants to say some more, no?
Huh?
Perhaps Emma wants to say some more?
I don't know.
No, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
You clarified what I needed. And you know,
In the United Front, was it not a bit, Ian, was it not a bit like in Germany when in the Nazi Party you had socialists at one time, and then you and then they were all in the same party. So of course comes a time when the Nazis crushed the whole of the left. What was that, Ian? Was that the night
Well,
of
there
the
was,
non
I mean, the socialists in the Nazi Party, there was a left wing of the Nazi Party,
left wing, I mean.
which used pseudo-socialist rhetoric, the Strasser Wing. You wouldn't really call them socialists at all. They were right-wing populists with an element of anti-Semitism and hostility to capitalism as long as it was Jewish. They used a certain amount of left-wing rhetoric, but they were not really on the left. They were Hitler actually slaughtered them, of course, in the Light of the Long Knives, but they were not really an ally. They were a symptom of the all parties have a left wing and a right wing. You know, it's just even the Nazi Party had a left wing and a right wing. They have different views within them, but that doesn't make them progressive. Yeah, that doesn't make the left wing of the Nazi Party progressive. I think that's what you're talking about, isn't it? Possibly. I don't know.
Is it a good idea, Ian, to say that in the when the Kuomintang and the communists made the United Front, the same thing happened because they were in the same organization now, and
Possibly,
then Chiang Kai-shek just got all the comrades assassinated.
Well, the thing is, there was a left Kuomintang, and after the defeat of the revolution in Shanghai, I can't remember what the month was, but it was sometime in 1927. After that, there was the left Kuomintang. There was a left expression of the Kuomintang, and Stalin went ahead and made a bloc with them as well. And I think it was in Wuhan, or can't remember exactly where it was. They massacred the workers as well, in a sort of reprise of what happened in 19 in Shanghai earlier. So yeah, I mean, the left, they're bourgeois parties. They were not the same as the Nazi Party. I mean, the Nazi Party was a fascist reaction against the workers' movement. The Kuomintang was actually partly a reaction against imperialist domination. It was, the Sun Yat-sens, who founded the Kuomintang, had a supportable element to it, and it was nothing necessarily wrong with at least doing some work inside the Kuomintang, as it's nothing necessarily wrong with communists doing some work inside other bourgeois parties, in some of the ones around in South America at the moment. People that, the sort of people in Venezuela and wherever, there's nothing inherently wrong with it, because these are not fascist parties. They're not right-wing parties, but they are bourgeois parties. And in the end, they will turn against the communists if you establish a real communist party. But, it's a slightly more complex argument. But I think total entryism, i.e. liquidation, into a bourgeois workers' party, into a bourgeois party like the Kuomintang, was going too far. And, I think you had to have a slightly more nuanced attitude to that. But I think entryism into the Kuomintang was an error, total entryism anyway, and that's what Stalin did. It was an error of the bureaucracy, There is some debate on the left about where how far you can go with that. And I think Jerry Downing actually has a different view of it to me. He thinks you can actually enter into a bourgeois party. You can vote for Sinn Féin and things like this, which I wouldn't. So I wouldn't do, vote for Sinn Féin in Ireland, for instance. I wouldn't do that. I think that these are still not workers' parties. And although you have to be sensitive to the fact that they reflect struggles against oppression in some circumstances, you can't liquidate into them or dress them. What does the Communist International say? You have to wage a struggle against those who try to dress up the bourgeois national liberation movement in communist colours. And I think that's the danger of that situation. And I think you have to be very careful not to do that, because otherwise you're creating a rod for your own back. And the bourgeoisie will do what I was suggesting, what I noted earlier on, like when the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce effectively called for the dictatorship of a revolutionary dictatorship, while carefully leaving it ambiguous what its class nature would be. They will do things like that to try and fool the working class and to try and fool the peasantry in countries where there's a large oppressed peasantry. They'll do all sorts of dirty tricks. And you have to be very careful not to give them not to give them credibility and dress them up in communist colours. That's my view anyway.
Can I come back?
Yeah, of course you can, yeah.
And the interesting bit is that 20 years later, in 49, 47, 49, the Chinese had learned. So the failure in the end of the Stalin view is that Mao Zedong learned from this, and they changed, and they won in 1949. And so it goes to show that these things are not written in stone. We don't have to go again through all these things. If we maintain the study of all these matters, we don't have to re-go through, go again through the same processes. And this is the importance. We might go through the same processes, similar, but not we can foresee them because we will have learned from the previous time when it happened. This is why each one of us, we must study these things. If we're serious about socialism, we must know about these things.
So, does anybody want to speak? Because I wouldn't mind coming back on that. But if anybody else wants to speak, I don't want to monopolize this discussion. If anybody's got anything they want to say, please speak up.
I don't think it will ever be again that desperate situation, because that was the first worker state, wasn't it?
Can I just say on that question of China after the Second World War, I think that's another very complex argument, and that the creation of the deformed worker state in China is a difficult question, because you might think that that Mao learned from Stalin and he didn't do some of the most outrageous things that Stalin did in the 20s. That is true, but Mao did not lead the working class. He led the peasant war, and it was a different dynamics. But if you look at what Mao's program was when he took power, it was a block of four classes. It was not the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. It was a block of four classes, which was the working class, the poor peasantry, the rural petty bourgeoisie, and the national bourgeoisie, or something like that. I can't remember. I mean, I think that's correct. It might be slightly the nuance of a difference on there, but the national bourgeoisie was part of the block of four classes that Mao tried to construct, and therefore he was actually trying to make an alliance with the Chinese bourgeoisie and create what he called new democracy, right? So his basic, although his tactics were different, he was based on the peasant war, which the Chinese Communist Party in the 20s was based on the working class in the cities like Shanghai and Wuhan and wherever. It was based on a peasant war. His still strategic aim was a class collaboration regime with the national bourgeoisie. But what happened instead is he had an independent armed force, and so when the national bourgeoisie said no, he was able to expropriate them, Whereas in 1927 they were not able to do that because they didn't have power. When Mao had gained power by his peasant war, he had the power to attack the bourgeoisie, and he did. And he collectivized the economy and created a workers' state with its own bureaucracy, ready-made almost, in the course of the present war. But his objectives were to create a cross-class regime. It's just the bourgeoisie wouldn't play, And the pressure of US imperialism, the attacks on it by US imperialism, particularly in the Korean War, where they threatened it with nuclear weapons, actually really forced him to go much further than he originally intended and overthrow the bourgeoisie itself, get rid of capitalism, And I think that's a very, that is an interesting subject, because in hindsight, it's very difficult to decipher what actually happened in China. And this is where I think the Spartacist League were very good, because they actually analyzed a similar process in Cuba. And the difference is that in Cuba, the party that did this was not formally Stalinist. It was not communist, at least not at the beginning of the process. It was a July 26 movement. But it did the same thing as Mao's peasant armies did in China. But it did it without the communist banner. And it adopted the communist banner later. It turned itself into a communist party after it took power. But that is a different argument, and we could probably have a. I think we should have a discussion on that as part of the post-war revolutions, the post-war deformed social revolution in China, in Cuba, in Vietnam, in Yugoslavia, in Albania. I'm trying to think. There's a few others. There's one or two that failed, like Nicaragua, that never quite got there. But those are a different thing, I think. Paul wants to speak.
A slightly different, well, it's quite far from the text itself. But obviously, in recent times, given what you and Marie were talking about the various forces and then that learning that in fact some groups were not communist, although they were using the language communist. I didn't foresee it at the time, but I'm beginning to foresee how it might be a problem with the invention of the bricks. But because Ian, I remember from stuff that you've written, you were much more skeptical about the bricks than I was at one point. I saw it as a way to maybe it would allow the working classes of each of those individual countries to rise up, and then you could get sort of a world communism that way. But on the other hand, if we're not careful, the BRICS arrangement could actually allow some of the countries to become even more capitalist. I guess I'm not really explaining myself very well, but basically, at the moment, everyone's thinking, "Oh, bloody Americans, bloody," it's, but it's not the Americans, it's the system. And of course, and there's a danger in thinking that somehow all these countries that are growing BRICS, a big trading bloc, they're not socialist countries, are they, on the whole? They're still trying to trade under the capitalist model. And so that's why, yes, I was celebrating when each of the countries joined the BRICS, and I still think it's a good thing. The Americans do need taking down a peg or two, but we mustn't think that that is the end goal. And I'm slightly concerned that some people do think Brits is like the end goal and everything will be, well, not quite happy clappy, but you know what I'm getting at, don't you? I'll stop there, thanks. I don't know if that made any sense, but
Makes a lot of sense.
yeah.
Who else wants
Yes, I
to
I think what Marie was saying about the situation in Shanghai, it was the Russian Communist Party that asked the Chinese to make an alliance and work with Chiang Kai-shek. So they probably wouldn't have done that and made the mistakes they did, and all those Trotskyists wouldn't have been massacred if they hadn't listened to Stalin.
Anybody else want to speak? Nope, not from now. I'll just come in and make a couple of remarks about what Paul said. I agree with Paul. I think BRICS is supportable as long as you don't dress it up as something that it is not. It is not a communist alliance. It is not socialist. What it is, it's an alliance of countries that are not imperialist, resisting in some economic and diplomatic sense imperialist domination of the world. And I think that's supportable insofar as it goes, But it doesn't go as far as the revolution or socialism or anything. None of these countries are socialist. Russia is not socialist. Russia is a as we put forward in our recent statement of the LCFI, we consider Russia to be a deformed capitalist state, a capitalist state with remnants of decades of the dictatorship of the proletariat, mangling it and making it so it's fun has major differences with capitalism as it's historically evolved in other parts of the world, and certainly with imperialism. It's a capitalism that's been so marked by the previous dictatorship of the proletariat as to make it possibly unviable and liable to revert in some sense. But it's not socialist. Putin is no socialist. You know, he's a conservative but rather unusual bourgeois who also at times genuflects to socialist phraseology. You know, sometimes, but other times he's very conservative. You know, sort of political schizophrenia in a way. But that reflects what the Soviet, what Russia is. It's a capitalism that's deformed by decades and decades of a form of dictatorship of a proletariat, which created its productive forces. That's what's so amazing about it. The productive forces that make Russia powerful were created under the dictatorship of the proletariat in the main. So it creates a very strange sort of material phenomena, doesn't it? You know, it's very contradictory. But yeah, we should defend it against imperialism, you know, as long as we don't close our eyes to what its problems are, you know. Mark wants to speak.
Yeah, do we know what's left of the Soviet Union in Russia? Can we put our fingers on it?
I think we can, yes. The bulk of its productive capacity was created by the USSR. You know, the fact that it was able to retreat from neoliberalism in a way that, you know, the massive privatization attacks of the Yeltsin regime in the 90s has been largely rolled back. And the economy, it's a mixed economy. It's probably about 50-50, you know. A big chunk of it has been restatified. Now, I don't think that would be possible. You know, certainly it happened peacefully. It happened fairly organically because as a result of mass pressure. Something similar actually happened in China in a slightly different way because there was large-scale privatization, but not a neoliberal shock, but there was considerable privatization which caused hardship to sections of the working class in China. And there was a big protest against it. It went through the apparatus and it was reversed, you know. That happened a bit later than it did in Russia. It happened in the 20-teens, in the mid-20-teens, as I understand. It was in Russia. It really began in the sort of late 2000s under Putin, you know. But it was a definite change of direction, a definite move away from neoliberalism. Although it wasn't, the neoliberalism was nowhere near as severe in China because the bureaucracy tried to restore capitalism from above. And did it, in fact, but in a different way to in Russia, where it was done by Yeltsin and the Chicago Boys and people like that. You know, so I think they're different examples of this contradictory phenomena. You know, they're both huge countries, and their productive power was created outside of capitalism. You know, and that's what's so unusual about this situation. It's so contradictory. Marie wants to speak again.
Yeah, just a few more words about this, about Mark, what Mark said. I think I agree with what you said. I looked into it about 2 weeks ago or three. I looked into all the industries which are in Russia. I based myself on somebody else who had studied it. And the long and the large is that there is about, let's say, 12 enormous companies, enterprises or industries, and they are nationalized and they were renationalized, as Ian said. And then you have perhaps another 20 or 30 small things, small ones, but which are quite secondary. So they are the many, there's plenty of them, but they are not decisive in the economy. And then the other thing, I'm talking about Russia, eh? And another thing which, Perhaps Ian doesn't quite agree with me, is the foreign policy. You look at the foreign policy of Russia over, for example, Palestine and over Syria and over Iran and over Venezuela. It hasn't been a bourgeois policy. The bourgeois policy is to defend Israel and to defend the United States and NATO, and the actual action of confronting NATO is an event, a shattering event, because the consequences is now Russia is being bombed. Every so often there's a bomb that goes inside Russia, and this is not, this is a war. It is not an event which is happening on the frontier. And so I think the leadership where Putin is did not follow the oligarchs, as so-called. The oligarchs just wanted a good life and making plenty of money. But he, that leadership, wanted to actually return to some greatness, which is perhaps it got a bourgeois aspect to it. But at the same time, he could not do it on the bourgeois basis because they already can. Capitalism doesn't want a competitor there. So, I propose we discuss that again in future when Ian discusses the revolutions of today.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I just noted what Diana put in the chat. It's true. I mean, the Communist Party is enormously influential in Russia. It's the main opposition. It puts pressure on Putin. It criticizes Putin from the left, including over Ukraine. It criticizes him for not doing something about what was going on earlier, you know. And it's got a following, a real following. And of course, in China, the Communist Party is still in power in a form, in a formal sense. And there are different trends within it, some of which are very bourgeois and even billionaire. The general secretary, what's it, Xi, is actually a billionaire himself, but there's a lot of different trends in that, you know. And it's, you know, as I said, it's capitalist, but with very peculiar characteristics, to misparaphrase Deng Xiaoping, you know. It's capitalism with deformations that come from its prior history of decades and decades of non-capitalist development. So it's a very contradictory society again, you know. Trotsky talked about the USSR being a contradictory society halfway between capitalism and socialism at one point, you know.
Wonderful.
And Ch Russia and China are very contradictory societies because they have a capitalist dominant ethos in some sense, but there's a huge modification of it from the decades and decades of productive development without capitalism, you know, that massively changes what they are and what they can be, you know. Sorry, Mark Popestate wants to come back again. Cheers.
What amazed me about China was the fact that Shanghai, they had TV screens in their small squares and so on, and people were actually gathering around listening to it and sitting down and spending a long time watching it. Because at one point I actually sat down to watch it, although I didn't know what was going on. It was fascinating. But there were waves of people coming to listen to it. Could you imagine that happening here?
No, no, no.
I don't think so. So there's something there, isn't there?
Well, definitely,
I must say, I see that they are worker states.
I think you're wrong
Yes.
about that. I don't see how they can be.
Ian says I'm wrong. Because it cannot be capitalist state. Capitalism is too exhausted.
Well, I don't see how they can be workers' states because they're not based on fundamentally on statified economy, the collectivized economy. That's the problem. They have a mixture, you know, it's a mixed economy. Yeah, in both cases, in slightly different ways, of course. You know, but there's more billionaire. There's actually, in formal terms, more billionaires in China than there are in the United States. Although it's four times the size of the United States. And those billionaires are nowhere near as wealthy as the ones in the United States. Nevertheless, there's a lot of billionaires in China, including at the top level of the Communist Party. That doesn't add up to a worker state to me. I mean, it's a funny phenomenon, but it's not a, I don't think you can call it a worker state.
Most do.
No.
Behaves like one.
It behaves sometimes like one.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, some not always. Paul, sorry, you got your hand up again.
Yeah, I just wanted to challenge my worry about the whole concept that somehow that Russian trying to work a state. I suppose the key question is, when you go to work in the morning, what is your key relation with that workplace? Are you working collectively with a whole group of other people to decide what you're going to produce that week, or is it, as I suspect, an employer-employee relationship? And I suspect Russia today, not the Soviet Union, but today, I think Russia is probably an employer-employee
I think
relationship.
so, yes.
And so, in that sense, that might sound simplistic, but in that sense, it's not a worker state. Might be anti-imperial, but it's still capitalist.
That's what I think as well. Anybody else want to speak? If Marie wants to come back, she's very welcome.
Yeah, I wanted to come back here.
Yeah, sure.
If that's okay. Right, yeah, it seems to me that what we have looked at is a time in history when there was only one worker state, and it was in the Civil War. They had lost a whole layer of people, who those who go to the front to fight, who had been killed. The rest of them were reincorporated into the economy. They had to run the state. So those who actually did that and knew what they wanted and to plan were the rest of the communists. And in there, all sorts of people were reincorporated in the leadership, because it was necessary, not necessarily because there was a bureaucracy, because the state had to function. And it seems to me that such dire situation is not to happen again. This happened once in those conditions. It doesn't mean that the next time that we build a worker state is not going to be very difficult. But I think these difficulties will be much less because the experience will have been made. We have already seen that there is a retreat after the revolution, that it is in the antagonism of classes, this is necessary to happen. It has to happen, and then one then must foresee it and preempt it. And it seems to me there are parallels to be made in this debate with the trade unions. When you look at the trade union bureaucracy, it's very similar. It's not the boss. It's not the boss. It's not like the bureaucracy is not a class. It's not capitalism, capitalist class in the document that we are learning from. But it's the same with the trade union bureaucracy. It's not the boss, but it behaves very much like it. And when it comes to it, for example, in the general strike in 1926, well, the TUC lent itself to Stalin's policy. You know, they coordinated with each other. They supported each other, and the weight and the authority of the communist of the Soviet Union over the communists in Europe was very large, and even in Britain, and that was after 1926. That was after the Bolshevik Revolution. And the fact that Stalin and the leadership of Russia was behaving as it was gave support and substance to the position and to the position of the TUC, which was to don't go so far. We don't want too much conflict, and the people will be killed. You know, the same arguments as are being used in the document here, where we don't want so much trouble, and you don't want to go and fetch a revolution. And all this weighs on people when they are insecure, and particularly in this country where social democracy believes that capitalism can be reformed. which is what labor is about. We go to government and we make a better capitalism than the capitalists. And this is killing. This is killing for the working class. This sort of thing.
Yeah. Anybody else want to speak? Well, just very briefly on that. I mean, I think you're right about the character of the bureaucracy as the workers, the deformed workers' state, is not the same as the ruling class. And I don't think that I think there are elements of anti-socialist. I mean, the point about Stakhanovism and piecework and all that sort of thing. But overall, the relationship is one of a bureaucracy within the labour movement to the working class, albeit, you know, in very difficult conditions, as it was in Russia in the 30s and the 20s, even, you know. But I think it's not the same now. The Russia and China are not really run by a labour bureaucracy. There are elements of a labour bureaucracy that makes up the bourgeoisie, the peculiar bourgeoisie in Russia, because it has this deformed character that comes from its decades, as I said, without capitalism, you know. So even the bourgeoisie is marked by its past as a labour bureaucracy, or a big chunk of it. And it has habits of work, and it has constraints which are based on its prior history. And it's not imperialist. This has not succeeded. It has not created an imperialist type economy, as imperialism actually gains its wealth from the transfer of value from underdeveloped countries. That is where imperialism's. That's why imperialist countries have become so much more powerful productively and economically than the underdeveloped world. It's this thing about de-development and the sucking of value out of the colonial and semi-colonial world. That is not how Russia reacts to the rest of the world. That is not Russia's relationship with the global South. And the result is that many people, many bourgeoisies and ordinary people in the global South see Russia as part of the global South. Even though, because it doesn't behave like part of the global north, i.e. the imperialist west, it doesn't work like that. And even though Russia is much more productive and powerful than any, and so is China, actually, Russia and China together are so much more productive and powerful than any of the countries in the global south. And in some ways, they actually might be all even more productive and powerful than some of the imperialist countries, if not all of them. But they are not getting rich at the expense of the global south, and therefore they're seen as allies. That's the peculiarity of that form of capitalism. It's not imperialist. Incidentally, I'll tell you one thing. I bumped into the Adrian Greenman of the EPSR yesterday, and had a most remarkable conversation. He was actually arguing now that Russia is imperialist and denouncing us for defending it, you know. Which is, I think Marie was talking about this a little while ago. But I think he's fundamentally wrong. I think they've taken a bad turn, if that's their position. You know, I mean, our old friend Chris Barrett, who me and Turan spent a lot of time talking to before he tragically died, would not have agreed with that at all. He was a member of that group who died of a vaccine reaction to a COVID vaccine about 3 years ago or something. But anyway, I think that you know, I just mentioned that as an aside because Marie was talking about them the other day. And but yeah, I think there is a difference between the Russia, a major difference between Russia and China today and Russia and China under the Stalinist regimes. But I think they're also different to imperialism, you know. They are a peculiar, I wouldn't use the word hybrid because I used that term earlier. I think that they are capitalism that's deformed by its socialist origin, you know, or semi-socialist, or it was part of a transition towards socialism. That's what a deformed workers' state was, a block transition towards socialism. Complicated. It's not an easy thing to do to characterize, but the world is not so simple, is it? Yeah. Paul wants to speak again. Sorry.
Yeah, on the point, on the accusation that Russia's imperialist, I think the trouble with some of these ultra left groups like the FWP type, because they're the one of those groups that argue that. And I think what it comes down to them, they've got such a simplistic view about what it is to be in Pro League. I think they narrow it down to the fact that Russia is a huge landmass and it's got lots of natural resources. So I think the assumption is made that, is that they're in Pro League, when in fact they weren't in. Those groups that accuse Russia of being imperialist need to go back to the drawing board and actually relearn what imperialism is, because they don't seem to understand it. So that would be my response to them. Thanks.
Yep. Anybody else? I see what Maria's put in the chat. I'm just typing a little response to it.
Mark wanted to speak.
Yeah, Mark can speak. Yeah, you wanted to say
no,
something.
No.
Well, I thought I saw your hand, Mark.
No. Have I still got a handle? No. No. I'm on.
So you're typing a reply, are you, Ian?
Only for a second.
Because you could tell us, tell everybody.
Well, I'm just saying that, that some forms of capitalism cannot compete with the imperialists. If they try, they simply become prey. That is the bulk of the global south. Whereas Russia's whole decades and decades of economic development happened without capitalism. So it really is not conditioned to do that, is it? It probably wouldn't be able to compete on that level, and it's got no real economic drive to do that. So, I mean, there are other ways of making money other than sucking value out of the global south. It's an ideal. I mean, there are ideal concepts of capitalism which really don't exist in the real world, but maybe the closest to them is the non-imperialist capitalism of countries where capitalism has been restored without the chance of exploiting other countries. That's a possibility. I think it's not a viable form of capitalism in the long run, I don't think, but it's not the same thing as imperialism. That's my view. But it's still, I mean, lots of things in this world are contradictory. And I think this is one example. That's just what I was more or less what I was saying, really. Marie, sorry.
Yeah, about this. I noticed that in Burkina Faso, the new leader there went to Moscow, and he made a speech where he thanked Russia for having intervened there against these ISIS people. They are like ISIS. And the French, who were in fact hiding it, but they were behind this ISIS, the French and the English and probably Americans. And so it seems to me that in that part there, you got Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, and there's two or three others. Russia is involved, but it is not pumping anything. And it's even helping them out. Making commercial agreements. So that is definitely outside the functioning of an imperialist.
Anybody else want to speak on any of this? If not, should we think about winding up this discussion and go on to any other business if anybody wants to? So I'll stop the recording because we record this as a podcast. So we can